Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to baseball historian Harvey Frommer, author of the beautiful new coffee table book, Remembering Fenway Park, an oral and narrative history of the Boston Red Sox. Stick around. The old ballpark will still be standing when I get done with Harvey.
Hey, did you know that you can listen to the latest Mr. Media on your phone with the Stitcher app? Stitcher is smart radio for your smartphone. Mr. Media is on demand and on the go with Stitcher. Download Stitcher for your phone today. Get the free download at Stitcher.com. That's S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.com.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. You know, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Stop by and check it out. There are more than 700 archived celebrity interviews for your listening pleasure. The show is brought to you today by 1-800-DIAL-DJs.com. Planning a wedding, mitzvah, or corporate event in the New York, New Jersey, or Pennsylvania area? For any and all occasions, call 1-800-DIAL-DJs nationwide at 1-800-DIAL-DJs. And ask for DJ Ira. He'll take good care of you. That's 1-800-342-5357. We're online, 1-800-DIAL-DJs.com. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of Tampa Bay Rays fans who wonder how many years of pasting the Bo Sox it will take for Harvey to write Remembering Tropicana Field in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. As a Tampa Bay Rays fan, I wish we had a stadium as beautiful and legendary as Boston's Fenway Park. But I take solace in knowing that just 13 years into its life as home of the Red Sox, even Fenway had its faults, right? Now, just play along, Harvey. You'll get your turn in a moment. Like Frommer's previous book, Remembering Yankee Stadium, Remembering Fenway Park, an oral and narrative history of the home of the Boston Red Sox, captures all the pageantry, successes, and humiliation that make a ballpark a home for legions and generations of fans. In his now familiar style of patching together a quilt of memories from ballplayers, managers, executives, fans, and sports writers alike, Frommer unwinds all the drama and even some of the silliness. And I'm looking right at you, Manny Rodriguez, relieving yourself behind the scoreboard during a lull in the action, that gives character to concrete and steel. Now, I'm not a Red Sox fan, but if I were, I'd probably want to find a copy of Remembering Fenway Park under my pillow in time for opening day. And Harvey Frommer, welcome back to Mr. Media.
Mr. Media, Bob Andelman, it's a pleasure to be back with you.
Good to have you. Great book. I mean, it's just a beautiful piece of work.
I take a lot of pride in it. I was poised to do the definitive book on Fenway Park, and people have called it that. It's gotten wonderful reviews. It's just been out for a couple of weeks now. And if I hadn't written it, I would have bought it for myself.
That's an endorsement, folks. Man. So, you know, right before we went on the air, we were talking, and I had misunderstood. I thought you had always been a Red Sox fan and had jumped over to do the Yankee book. But in fact, it's the other way around.
You have it backwards. I put an adjective before backwards, but it's a family audience. Anyway, I grew up in New York City. I actually grew up in Brooklyn. I was back there in the days of Ebbets Field, the old Yankee Stadium, and the Polo Ground. And I wrote for the Yankees for 18 years. I did about 8 books that have Yankee content, including Remembering Yankee Stadium. And I lived and breathed everything Yankees, and I was called the Yankee writer. My publisher then suggested, since you've done this wonderful book on Yankee Stadium, why not go over now to Fenway Park? So the Red Sox people in charge knew of me as the guy who wrote all this Yankee stuff, and nevertheless, they were as welcoming as could be. Red Sox Nation embraced me. I got total cooperation from the Red Sox with access to interviews. I never met a group of fans as nice or a group of players as nice as I interviewed. And since I live in New England, teach at Dartmouth College, where I'm stuck now after 5 inches of snow yesterday, my wife said, why don't you convert? Not change your religion, but change your allegiance. And here I am, a brand newly minted member of Red Sox Nation. Nobody believes me, but I love the Red Sox.
That's amazing. Now, do you think if it had gone in the other direction, that you had done 8 or 10 Red Sox books first and then went to the Yankees and said, I want to do a book on Yankee Stadium, that those guys would have been as welcoming as the Red Sox were?
Never.
There you go.
That's a short answer. You don't want the long one.
But, I mean, how does someone convert from being a lifelong Yankees guy to the Red Sox? I mean, there had to be more factors than just being welcome there.
Well, the Yankees have been notoriously been known as a colder organization. And the Red Sox, you know, if I wanted a photo, I wanted a phone number, if I wanted access to something, had a question, they would help me immediately. They were just as nice as could be. We have an event planned for April 7th, the day before Fenway Park opens the 2011 season. This event is at Fenway Park.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be the Dartmouth Alumni Association of Greater Boston, and I'll be doing a talk there, and then there's going to be a tour for those who wanted of Fenway Park that night by one of the guys I interviewed for the book, a tour guide. Where do you see something like this happening? I was able to get the Dartmouth Alumni Association a really nice discount from the Red Sox for the rental of space and variety of food and drink. Now, I don't think that could have happened even in your lovely ballpark.
Oh, you never know what they'd agree to there.
Well, never.
But, I mean, you know, I mean, both teams, both parks, Yankee Stadium, Fenway, have incredible history. You know, they both share Babe Ruth, for that matter. They both mm-hmm. shared Roger Clemens.
And they also almost shared Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams.
There you go. And clearly there was, and the photos in the book show that DiMaggio nonetheless had a relationship with the Red Sox.
Yeah, he did.
To go from being a Yankees guy to a Red Sox guy, I mean, there's probably places in the Bronx that you're just not welcome anymore.
Well, I come armed.
A quick tongue?
Quick tongue and lots of books to give away.
Well, let me ask you this. What did you learn from doing the Yankee book that you were able to improve upon with the Fenway book?
I didn't learn really anything. I did the best job that I could. The book was well received. It sold well. But what I did have as an edge in doing the Remembering Fenway Park book was A, the cooperation that I mentioned before, and B, I think the story of Fenway Park is a more interesting story. It's got more of a narrative arc than the story of Yankee Stadium. The story of Fenway Park really began in 1912, and it got off to a bad, bad start because there were a couple of rain delays, and also the Titanic sunk, and the news of the ballpark opening was buried, you know, in the Boston press. So that was for starters. And then they had some good years, and then they fell on hard times, especially with a guy named Harry Frazee, the guy who said the best thing about being the owner of the Red Sox is taking the train in New York and going to my New York apartment.
That was a great line, and I got to tell you that the story about the Titanic sinking at the time that Fenway opened, I mean, that sounded like a story straight out of like Tampa Bay sports history. That would be like Tropicana Field opened on 9/11. That would be the equivalent. I mean, if that had happened. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay, no problem. Anyway, then there's the sale of Babe Ruth to the Yankees, and other Red Sox immortals to the Yankees. It really made the Yankees, who had not been a good franchise, become one of the best franchises in baseball. And the Red Sox really started suffering, and the ballpark became worse and worse and worse in terms of its upkeep. Along came Tom Yawkey. And Tom Yawkey was a multimillionaire, a zillionaire, who came in, spent a lot of money buying all kinds of players, or getting all kinds of players, future Hall of Famers like Ted Williams and Joe Cronin, Lefty Grove, Jimmy Fox, Bobby Doerr, etc. And the team did well, but it never really could win anything. And people said it was the curse of the Bambino. I think it was the curse, really, of Tom Yawkey not really putting a team together on the field, but putting together a collection of stars.
Mm.
The team went on, and you know, it won in 46, the Tennis, but lost to the Cardinals, 67, a great year of the impossible dream. Again, they couldn't win a championship, and the years went on. The Yankee-Red Sox rivalry was flaming. They had good teams, but they could not win. In 2004, which was perhaps the greatest sports story maybe of the century, came along, and the Red Sox, who nobody thought would do it, did it. They beat the Yankees in that playoff series and went on and swept the Cardinals, and they won their first world championship in 86 years. But embedded in this narrative, in addition to what I just mentioned, is the narrative about Yorkie dies, his wife takes over the team, and the Yorkie Trust takes over the team, and the ballpark starts to fall on hard times. It's not kept up, and you have all of these different groups jockeying, including a group headed by Don DiMaggio, to try to buy Fenway Park and buy the Red Sox and do something with Fenway Park. To do something was to destroy it. All of these groups, except for the John Henry group, they decided that they would, if they got the team, that they would enhance and keep Fenway Park. And there was the Save Fenway Park Committee, which is also the heroes and heroines of this book. They fought hard to see to it that an ownership came in that was pledged to save Fenway Park. Now, 600 straight sellouts plus and counting, the ballpark looks just beautiful for something that's going to be 100 years old, and tourists who don't even understand the game of baseball are flooding into Boston to just sit at a game at Fenway Park. And it's such an intergenerational ballpark. You see, you know, of all ages, all types of people. Even Ray fans come in and have a good time, you know, watching what's going on. And the ballpark has all of these odd angles, the green monster, the great green grass that's there. And before the game starts, you have all this hype and hoopla and goings on with bands playing and people out in Yorkie Way having a great, great time. So I think you don't have no ballpark, and I'm a baseball historian, allegedly, in my memory and in my reading and in my research, compares to the magic, the mystique, and the maniacy, if you will, of Fenway Park. Not even the old Yankee Stadium in its prime with Mantle and Maris and Casey Stengel, you know, doing his thing, etc. This is just an American treasure.
Just as a footnote, Harvey, I do have to say that I think for the last three seasons, Rays fans have had a wonderful time at Fenway Park.
They did, yeah.
Ever since this guy Dan Johnson got off a taxi cab and walked into the park, and yeah. what about, I mean, you know, we talked about Yankee Stadium and Fenway, but doesn't Wrigley Field have a place in that group?
They've been much more of a losing type of franchise. That's the problem. They do have a loop, though, because they're going to be 100 years old in 2013, as Ebbets Field would have been 100 years old in 2013. They were built in 1913. So a lot of these oldies came up around the same time in baseball history. But I'm just prejudiced. I don't think with the Northeastern or the New England ethos that permeates Fenway Park, the kinds of fans that come in there, the wonderful Irish accents and storytellers that I've gotten in my book. There was Nuns Day at Fenway Park. There was never Nuns Day at Wrigley Field. There was Ladies Day at both ballparks. But there are all kinds of idiosyncratic things that took place at Fenway Park throughout the years. And I think with all due respect to Chicago Cubs fans, they never had a player like Ted Williams, and they never had a player like Carl Yastrzemski. They had some great players, but nobody at that level. They never had a player like Babe Ruth. And these are the players that walked, played, you know, were at that ballpark. Bobby Doerr, Johnny Pesky. You could reel off, I'm sure, on the other side, icons like Lou Piniella at Wrigley Field and others, but I think the Red Sox have it hands down in terms of the history and the colorful characters.
I have
Boggs, to name another one, Roger Clemens.
right? But I'm not a big, I'm not a Cubs fan at all. But Ernie Banks wouldn't be in that.
He was a gentlemanly type. I'm talking also about Bill Lee, Jimmy Pearsall, who lives in Chicago. Dom DiMaggio.
Mm-hmm.
I was the last one to interview him. He died a week or two after I did a phone interview with him. And he was annoyed that I even, you know, got him on the phone. He said, "I'm going to give you 5 minutes and that's it." I said, "Fine." 35 minutes later, he said, "You want some more time?" So, and he was like a lesser version of some of these icons that that team had. I got a quote from him in the book in the oral history versions of stuff that he gave to me, that what was it like when you played the Yankees, you know, when you were going in from the outfield and DiMaggio was going out, your brother Joe. He said, "What the hell, you think we stopped there in the middle of the center fielder's talk about how the family was and just went around our business?" Shame on you for a question like that. I didn't put the shame on you for a question like that in the book, though.
Those DiMaggio brothers, I'm sorry I never got to interview any of them. They sound like they were just a world of fun.
Yeah, we have a really touching story that I got from a Red Sox vice president, Larry Tanker, who arranged for the three DiMaggio brothers to be reunited, and it was actually reuniting them for the last time at Fenway Park. And it's such an incredible photo in the book. I think you probably have seen it, Bob.
It's a wonderful picture.
Yeah, that shot of them, you know, as old men here, but that Vince is on the left and Dom is in the middle, little Dom. And Joe is like almost looking wistfully off somewhere in space. And Dom had brought Vince in from California because Vince had been sick for a while. It turns out he had cancer. He died not too long after that photo. But that was an incredible story, too. So, you know, I don't think you have so many of those stories. I didn't get so many of those stories. Not that I'm knocking my own book, Remembering Yankee Stadium, but just the narrative of this book is page after page of interesting things. Louis Tiant, who was always one of my favorite pitchers, I never realized that his father was one of the great pitchers in Cuban baseball history, that the State Department intervened to get Louis Tiant Sr. to come to America, and they hadn't seen each other, father and son, for about 17, 18 years. And Louis, the younger, related to me for the book the story of what it was like for him to pitch with his father sitting in the stands behind home plate with that little hat on, and almost giving him body language signs as to what to do, you know, pitch by pitch. So that's another, you know, interesting wrinkle. And, you know, it goes on and on with the great stories that people told me.
I'm just curious, Harvey, covering and writing about the Yankees and all the books that you wrote about the Yankees all those years, I'm sure you couldn't help but learn things about the Red Sox and Fenway Park. Were there many things that you learned in researching this book about Fenway that surprised you or that you felt had not been told?
I think in the oral history of people, these were things that people had inside of them, like the story I just told you, the Tiant story. I don't think that really, you know, got as much ink as told from Louis Tiant's point of view and what it was like for him. I got Fred Lynn, you remember him, the great center fielder for the Red Sox. He explained how he played center field, of course, you know, all over the American League, but how difficult it was to play center field at Fenway Park. There were so many obstacles, all of those angles that literary writers, you know, have excelled over. He said that he could have broken his back or his arm or something. You had to really be very careful. You never knew where the ball would carom in terms of when it hit the wall or something. And center field posed a real challenge to a center fielder's body just to be functioning out there. So that was an interesting bit of insight.
I've always wondered what it must feel like to stand out and left with that giant green, well, monster behind you, and just feel dwarfed by it and know that, I mean, you know, these guys play in big stadiums and big, you know, concrete and steel contraptions, but that wall is just like nothing else.
Yeah, it is, and I interviewed Jimmy Pearsall, and my opening line to him, as I edit to other people that I interview, I'll feel free to use whatever you give me, and if you don't want me to use it, tell me it's off the record and I won't use it. And his response is, look, I'm about 92, 93 years old. I don't give a crap what you use. What can they do to me now? but he told me, you know, that he would throw balls off that monster, throw balls off anything he could just to see where they went. Hmm. And he did this, you know, hundreds and hundreds of them, and other players did the same thing. Yastrzemski became, you know, quite proficient at playing the ball off the wall, and we have the story in the book of the Bucky Dent home run, told by Bucky, told by Don Zimmer, told by Yastrzemski, et cetera, told by fans who were there. Most people didn't think it was a home run, and they didn't see it go in the net. The Dent himself was at second base. When he saw the umpire ruling, you know, that the ball got in, and he just went around the bases, and dead silence was in Fenway Park at that particular point in time. So that posed another, you know, problem in terms of what the ballpark was like for people, you know, playing the field. It's also a bit of a problem if you're a fan, because the seats are kind of jammed together. If you're in the middle of the row and you got to go to the men's room or the ladies' room, you know, have a bit of a problem on your hands. Or if you want to get refreshments, some of the sight lines are not too good. There are obstructions getting your way. But people tolerate all of that because it's just the feeling of camaraderie and the feeling that you're so, so close to the action that you can almost touch the players.
Mm. So what's next, as we're running out of time here? What's next for you?
Well, I have about three ideas, but I'm afraid to give them away because people somehow always get into them. We have three interesting ideas. All of them are oral histories, and one of them is non-sports.
Oh. Well, let me ask you this, Harvey. If the Rays should take the AL East for the third time in 4 years in 2011, what's it going to take to get you to do Remembering Tropicana Field?
About the same money that I got for this book.
Okay. All right. We'll see what we can do.
You got a couple of Bo Sox guys there, right?
Isn't that weird? I mean, yeah. Isn't it strange to see Manny Ramirez and Johnny Damon in Rays uniforms?
Yeah. Funny. Well, neither of them would consent to an interview for this book.
I thought that was strange. I would have guessed Damon would have talked to you, especially...
Yeah, I even know him. You know, not well, but I know him.
Well,
I guess they were otherwise engaged, but I had enough great people anyway.
Oh, there's I got to tell people that, I mean, there's just tremendous stories, great photos in the book. It's just that's why I said at the top of the show, if you're a Red Sox fan, you want somebody to give you this book. You want someone to buy this for you.
If you're a Rays fan, you want the book too. It's just pure baseball.
Well, yeah, that's true too. But
any fan, I think, would love it. As I said, I would buy it if I didn't write it.
Well, folks, listen, you can find Harvey Frommer's new book, Remembering Fenway Park, at great bookstores everywhere, or order it online at a great price right now at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. Harvey, are you online at all with you know, a website, Twitter, any of that kind of stuff?
I have a whole webpage devoted to the book. It's simply Harvey Frommer Sports, .com.
Okay.
/ Remembering Fenway.
Great.
So it's all one word, HarveyFrommerSports.com/ Remembering Fenway.
All right.
And you'll see all the reviews and stuff there. I got stuff from George Will and Dan Shaughnessy and our buddies Peter Gollenbach, mm-hmm. and Johnny Pesky. And we go up and down the line and just filling it out. And a lot of pictures there that you can see. And hopefully your podcast of this will be on that site too.
That would be good. Well, Harvey, thank you so much for joining us in Mr. Media today.
It's a pleasure. I hope to see you in person one of these days, not too long in the future.
Same here. Be well. And, folks, for more original interviews with your favorite sports writers, surf over to our main website, mrmedia.com, mrmedia.com. And if you've enjoyed today's show, subscribe for free to Mr. Media via email, RSS, or iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. And show your support of Mr. Media by clicking on our sponsors' ads or making a donation via PayPal to help defray the cost of producing the show. If you've got an idea for a guest, a comment on today's show, or would like to advertise on Mr. Media Radio, email me directly at bob@mrmedia.com. You can also follow Mr. Media on Facebook, Twitter, or our new YouTube video channel. Thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate you sharing a piece of your day with Mr. Media. Thanks for listening.
Now, this is the amazing Kreskin. If you could read my thoughts, you'd know you're listening to Mr. Media Radio.